It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered my home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. Congratulations! Who hasn't beat Daniel Garcia?
Welcome to episode 928 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, September 7th, 2025. It has now been 15 days since Rajah Jackson beat Psycho Stu into unconsciousness, and still, the man roams free. On the bright side, Psycho Stu is now home from the hospital after suffering what his wife says was a serious head injury. That's putting it mildly. But it was 30 years ago this past week, 30 years, that Ted Turner gave Eric Bischoff an hour of primetime television every Monday night on TNT. And WCW Monday Nitro debuted from the Mall of America. Now, when Bischoff tells it sometimes, and other people tell the story, they say that Turner gave him 2 hours every Monday. But Nitro did not expand to 2 hours until, God, what was it, 8 or 9 months later? Flying Brian beat Jushin Thunder Liger in the opener. Sting and Ric Flair wrestled each other as Lex Luger looked on in his puffy white dress shirt. Having just wrestled for the WWF 2 nights earlier, he was actually tagging with Shawn Michaels. So him showing up was a big surprise, and Hulk Hogan beat Big Bubba Rogers in the main event. And it was a night that, I mean, no hyperbole here, led to a period of transformation in the wrestling business that is still felt to this day. The official kickoff of the Monday Night War. And why the Mall of America? Because Bischoff knew the WCW had problems getting people to come to their TV tapings. So his mindset was, let's run a unique venue, a smaller venue like that, to mask the problem. See, he and Tony Khan have more in common than they may think. It took them a while to get going, but once the NWO angle launched the following year, they went unbeaten against Raw for 83 weeks straight. You know, for as influential as that show was, and just the way it changed the wrestling business, it's crazy to think that Nitro was only around for about 5 years. That was it. And 3 years ago this week was Brawl Out and the beginning of the end of CM Punk in AEW. You know, there are certain moments that you can point to where AEW lost a piece of itself. Cody Rhodes leaving was one of those moments, probably the first one. But Brawl Out was the other moment. And Punk eventually came back, but it was very short-lived, and then we all know what happened after that. And, you know, watching SmackDown on Friday night in Chicago with Punk and the return of AJ Lee, it's really something to think that Punk was working for the other place 3 years ago and how different things might look right now had that whole situation played out differently. Easily the darkest day in AEW history. But it's no dark day when it's a sound-off Sunday, so we got a lot to get into here. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the very top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on this show. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers, including Big B, Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Recon, Russell Bulware, The Georgia Nightmare, Timothy Tillis, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Joe Guy, You Are the Guy, thank you, my friend, Killshot, Keith Hart, it was great seeing you on Thursday too, brother, always a pleasure, and the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, back from the void, welcome back, brother. Good to see some of you in Philadelphia on Thursday for House of Glory. You know, I didn't even realize until I was stuck in an Uber trying to get to the venue from my hotel that it was opening night for the Eagles. The fucking Eagles were playing a game that night, but I ended up with a very entertaining driver who claimed to be the songwriter for a bunch of Taylor Swift songs and The Weeknd and a bunch of other artists that he has apparently met over the years. I guess they just asked him to write lyrics for their songs, and he did. He met Billie Eilish getting out of a cab, and they became friends, and he wrote some of her stuff. And same with Sabrina Carpenter. Every time a new song came on his Spotify playlist, he would tell me what role he played in making the song happen. And when I got a message, I mean, legit, I got a message in my Uber app asking me if everything was okay because my commute was taking longer than expected because we were stuck in all this traffic. I thought about sending a cry for help, but I was far too entertained by all of this. I mean, I met the man who may well have written every song ever made. And he drives an Uber. Who would have guessed it? And I tried to change the subject. He was like, oh, so what are you doing in town here? Where are you from? I'm like, well, I'm not from here. I'm from New York. Well, what are you here for? And I'm, you know, we're talking about wrestling. And I told him, you know, what I'm here for. Oh, you're a wrestling fan. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He wasn't a wrestling fan. He really didn't know much about it. But you know what he asked me about? The one thing he asked me about, the Rajah Jackson incident. He knew about that. He didn't know Raja's name. He just knew, oh, that kid, the son of the MMA fighter. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I know about that. Anyway, it was a fun night outside of Bully Ray saying my mother was probably a rat back in the day when I came out to inform him that his match with Zilla Fatu was opening the show, not closing it. I kept a far enough distance that he couldn't do anything to me. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't crack a smile when Zilla pinned him in 60 seconds to win back the Crown Jewel Championship. So I guess I can add being insulted and threatened by Bully Ray in Philadelphia to the list of things I've now been a part of in my 7 years with House of Glory. Our next show is back in New York on October 10th. That's the night before Crown Jewel. And let me tell you, it is a loaded show. We've got Killer Cross making his debut against Matt Cardona. We've got the return of the Hardys just 48 hours before their big Bound for Glory match with the Dudleys. You know, last time we had the Hardys, if you're wondering about their drawing power in 2025, it was an absolute madhouse. I mean, we've already sold out the first three rows. We've actually opened up fifth row seating. And of course, general admission is still available as well. But it's going to be one of our biggest shows of the year. Do not miss out on this. HOGWrestling.net. And Amazing Red is wrestling Leon Slater on that show, the TNA X Division champion, the man who unseated Amazing Red as the youngest X Division champion of all time. And then we're back to Chicago at Logan Square Auditorium on Friday, November 21st. I will be there. I hope you will be too. That Bully segment, by the way, with me and him and the match with Zilla, is up for free on the House of Glory YouTube channel, as is the main event between Amazing Red and Cedric Alexander, which is worth checking out. The big story of the week stems from SmackDown on Friday night. Really, it started building up on Monday night, so we should probably go back there first. We had a face-to-face confrontation in the ring between Becky Lynch and CM Punk. And Becky was a great instigator in this segment. She was doing everything that she could to annoy CM Punk and get under his skin and needle him. And she was out there, you know, explaining to him, they were trying to give an explanation for why she hates him beyond the fact that she's married to Seth Rollins and dresses him. She talked about how when Punk left the company all those many years ago and Becky was first starting out and first made the main roster, she had to sit through matches where people were chanting CM Punk's name because they didn't care enough about her matches to cheer for her or cheer against her. So they were too busy chanting CM Punk. And it's something that she never forgot. So they at least took a stab at trying to explain why this woman would have ill will towards this man beyond the fact that, you know, I'm married to the guy that you're currently feuding with. So they tried to add a personal element to it. And then she started smacking the shit out of him. Like, she was channeling her inner Stephanie McMahon. And she's smacking him and slapping him. And Punk, of course, he's not, can't touch her, so he's not allowed to defend himself or hit a GTS or anything like that. I mean, it's not 35 years ago in the Attitude Era. You're not going to see that shit in WWE television today. So Punk is just taking it and you know, not selling it. But then he leaves the ring. And he ends up in the back. He's talking to Adam Pearce. And he asks Adam Pearce, where's SmackDown on Friday? And Adam Pearce tells him, Chicago. Why? He goes, tremendous. everything that they did in this segment, everything they did on that show on Monday night was clearly setting up for the eventual return of AJ Lee. They never said her name. The fans did. The fans were chanting her name. But they never acknowledged her. They never said her name. But it was designed to get you to think, hey, I better tune into this show on Friday night because I think something big might be going down. And they were in Chicago, over 16,000 people at the Allstate Arena. And Becky was there. Seth Rollins was there. And Becky came out to the ring and was heeling on the various Chicago sports teams. Oddly enough, all but the Chicago Bears, which happens to be Seth Rollins' favorite team. And CM Punk came out. And we had Punk and Becky in the ring yet again. And Punk said, this is not about you. It's about your coward of a husband. Because he was in the crowd. Seth wouldn't even come to the ring. He was in the crowd watching all of this. And Becky's asking him, you know, how do you feel after what happened on Monday night when she was smacking the shit out of him? And Punk did acknowledge there, again, tons of AJ Lee chants in this building. And he acknowledged them and even said her name. And then he was pointing out various other people. Don't you think I can get someone like Bayley? I can get someone like the Eradicator, Rhea Ripley, to come out here and kick your ass. I don't have to do anything myself. I can get my sister in the front row to get out of her seat and come into this ring and beat you up. And Becky starts slapping him around again and daring him to find somebody to fight her. Punk gets out of the ring and he says, you know, would never put my hands on a woman. But thankfully, I know somebody who will. It was the perfect setup. And then they hit AJ's old music and out comes Mrs. CM Punk, AJ Lee herself, for the first time since 2015. She walks out and the look of fear, the look of shock and awe on the face of Becky Lynch was pitch perfect. And the pop for AJ when she came out was insane. Not unexpected, especially in Chicago, but it was insane. And she skipped her way down to the ring, again, like 10 years hadn't even gone by. Becky looked shell-shocked, and she's begging off, and eventually, you know, AJ got into the ring and attacked Becky, knocked her out of the ring, and Becky and Seth, they go limping off together. And it's this big celebration. Punk gets in the ring, and AJ jumps into his arms, and they share a kiss, and that's how they went off the air. Was it predictable? You bet. But that was intentional. It was supposed to be. Nothing they did over the last week would lead you to believe that they ever wanted this or expected this to be a surprise. This was meant to be a surprise the way that CM Punk's debut in AEW was meant to be a surprise, which is to say it was never meant to be a surprise. They never even mentioned Punk's name in the lead up to the first dance. But I think Tony booking a show called The First Dance at the United Center was kind of a dead giveaway. And so was Becky smacking Punk around on Monday night and then Punk asking Adam Pearce, oh, where's SmackDown on Friday? And so as with Punk's debut in AEW, which is still one of the loudest reactions that I have ever heard on a wrestling show. I mean, when I think of the without being in the building, when I think of the loudest, not even pops, just the loudest sustained reactions that I have heard on a wrestling show. The first thing I think of, and it wasn't like 5 minutes straight or anything. It was probably more like maybe 60 seconds, but it's still to me the loudest and the greatest pop of all time that I've ever seen was the night on that taped episode of Raw where Mankind won the championship and they hit the glass shatter and Stone Cold came out. And I mean, like, the hard camera was shaking. People were jumping up out of their seats. It was insane. After that, I might have to put the CM Punk debut in AEW in 2021. And then, of course, you have Punk's return to WWE in 2023. That's also kind of neck and neck. But that first dance reaction when he came out, again, he had been gone for 7 years. He was one of the biggest names in wrestling in the last 15 years. And so for him to go away for that long, and now he's back, live television in a major promotion. You know, it wasn't like he just showed up at a Ring of Honor show or TNA or anything like that. And he walks out there in the United Center in front of 15,000 people in his hometown. I mean, you couldn't have made it any better than they did. And so here, You didn't have to say her name, just like Tony Khan didn't have to say, hey, guess what? CM Punk is coming back this Friday. He just knew that people would tune in and that they would expect him to be there. And it was the same thing with AJ, and it didn't diminish her reaction at all. The people were loud as fuck when they hit her music and she came out. So Becky was great, I thought, in that segment. And it sets up the obvious mixed tag team match for Wrestlepalooza, which should be officially announced on Raw this Monday. What I'm hoping to see this Monday is that first in-ring back and forth on the mic between Becky and AJ. You know, Friday was the return. AJ didn't have to say a word, and she didn't. Monday should be where they take aim at one another on the mic. Unless they decide to save that for like a big contract signing the week after with all four of them, I could see that too. But you got to give us something good on Monday night. So that's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah, the thing about AJ Lee, for the most part, I think people are very happy to see her back. You know, she had a lot of fans. She wasn't in WWE on television for, I would say, a long period of time. It wasn't like she had like a 10-year run or anything like that. But in the time that she was there, she made enough of an impact. I mean, she was a major character on the television show. And she worked with all the big names. This is what people sometimes maybe don't understand or they don't remember. It wasn't just that, oh, she was the Divas champion. And she worked, you know, she was one of the most popular divas in the division during the Divas era of WWE. True. But even more importantly than that, they saw enough in her to have her working with all the big names during that last run that she had. She was working with John Cena. She was working segments with CM Punk and Daniel Bryan and Kane. You know, all these major names. They even made her the Raw general manager for a period of time. She was in some of the main event segments and closing segments on Monday Night Raw, week after week after week. So her return is a big deal for a lot of different reasons. It gets also a big name, you know, back in the women's division. Someone who a lot of people thought they would never see again. That she was just not going to come back. I mean, 10 years had gone by. There's a lot of parallels with her and her husband in terms of his return in 2023. When Punk came back, he came back more or less, it was 10 years later. Same thing with AJ Lee. 10 years later, the last match that she wrestled was March of 2015. I think it was the Raw after WrestleMania 31. I think it was a 6-woman tag on TV. And that was it. She retired. And I look at AJ Lee as the last big female return that I can think of in WWE. I mean, actually, there's only one other one that I could think of in terms of like what other major female returns could there be left now in WWE? And the only one other than AJ would be Mercedes. And Mercedes ain't coming back to WWE, not for a long time yet. She's very content where she is right now with all of her titles. You know, there's Paige, Soraya, but a Paige return would not be as big as an AJ Lee return. You know, AJ was only 28 years old when she retired. She's still only 38. We're not talking about a Legends return here for a nostalgia pop. She's all in, full time. We saw video of AJ with Triple H signing a contract. We didn't know what kind of contract it was. Now we do. According to BodySlam.net, AJ Lee has signed a full-time, multi-year contract with WWE. Full-time. So she is back for Wrestlepalooza. She's back for Survivor Series. She's back for the Royal Rumble. She's back for WrestleMania. All of it. Now, she did say a few years ago in an interview that the reason that she retired was due to a very bad neck injury that she suffered in her last year in the ring. I think it was the summer before she retired. To this day, she still gets numbness in her hands. And she said because of that, she would never wrestle again. Because she doesn't want to make it any worse. Outside of the numbness, she said at the time, I made it out unscathed. I'd like to keep it that way and not make things worse. And she said that she was never going to wrestle again. This was in 2022 that she said this. Now she's back. Now, she may limit the things that she does in the ring because of that. I mean, it's not like she was doing anything too crazy in her matches 10 years ago. But again, these women, like the quality of the women in that division today and some of the risks that they'll take, some of the moves they do, She may feel motivated to try to go tit for tat with them. Hopefully she can stay healthy and her neck is not going to be an issue for her. I'm sure she's weighed the pros and cons of that. And she knows her body. She knows what she can and can't do. And look, if her neck was that badly damaged, she wouldn't be wrestling because they would never clear her. They wouldn't allow her back in the ring. But I just thought that was very interesting that it was only, again, 2 or 3 years ago she's saying this. Like, this is why I had to step away from the ring and that you will never see me back in the ring again. And then I'm reading this news that not only is she back, she's back full time. It's like, wow. Okay. Talk about going from zero to 60. And in terms of the potential matches that there are for her, there's tons of them. Tons of women on the roster right now who were not there when AJ was there, who came in after she retired, and some of them who were fangirling over her return, like Roxanne Perez, dying to work with this woman. And a lot of these women probably never thought they would have the chance. Roxanne is one. Naomi is another. Right? AJ and Naomi, they had, I think, a couple matches together back in the early NXT days, back when NXT was still a game show. I was watching Naomi on her Twitter. She was ready to throw Big Jim out the damn window when she saw AJ come back. If you were following any of her tweets, she's like, I'm out for 9 months at least, and now she comes back. So when Naomi comes back, that's a match that she's going to be lobbying for. Liv Morgan is another obvious one. If you watch Liv Morgan, if you watch her mannerisms, especially in there like with Dom, certain things she does on TV, it's very clear that she was an AJ Lee fan. And she was at least somewhat influenced by AJ Lee. That is a natural match to do at some point. Becky Lynch is the here and now. They're going right into it with her and Becky Lynch. Becky Lynch is the Intercontinental Champion. If AJ pins Becky to win their mixed tag match at WrestlePalooza, she should automatically be the number one contender. Because if you beat the champion, you get a title match. That's how it should work. Actually, if you beat the champion, you should become the champion. But when you have like a non-title match or a tag match, if you beat the champion, that's it. You get vaulted up to that top spot. You're next in line. You should be challenging for the championship. Then you got Io and you got Stephanie and Rhea. Lots of people for her to work with. And when I say work, I'm not just talking like, oh, the actual matches. But the stories and the mic work to build to those matches. Like, there's a lot of fun stuff for them to do with her. So it was great to see her back. I had one person during the review on Friday night say, was that the greatest ending ever to a SmackDown? And it wasn't. It was a great ending. It was a very memorable ending. And husband and wife now own two of the more memorable returns in the history of WWE. Was it the best ending on SmackDown ever? It was not. But it was a great segment. I'll talk more about SmackDown here in a second. But we got to talk about the other women's championship. Because on Monday, we got a resolution to the women's world championship situation. Now, when Naomi announced that she was pregnant, she was obviously forced to vacate her title. So the title's been vacant for a few weeks. Adam Pearce told Stephanie Vaquer a couple weeks ago, I need another week. Give me another week. I got to sort things out. I got a name in mind. And then I'll let you know who your opponent is going to be and when your match is going to be for the women's world title. I don't know why Adam Pearce needed an extra week to get it done in storyline, other than they really want to stack that WrestlePalooza card. I mean, that's the real reason. They wanted to hold off as long as possible. But in the end, they went with the sensible choice. And they announced that at WrestlePalooza, in fact, this was the first match officially announced for that show, it will be the former champion, Io Sky, taking on Stephanie Vaquer to crown a brand new women's world champion. Two women who were owed title matches by Naomi. It only makes sense to let them fight one another. The winner is the new champion. That's it. Again, you didn't have to overcomplicate this. And on top of that, we're going to get a great fucking match between these two women. They've wrestled on TV before, but never one-on-one on a PLE. And you saw what Io and Rhea did at Evolution. That was one of the best matches all year. This could be that. Very much looking forward to that match. At the end of the show on Monday night, they set up the likely reunion of the Usos. Because Jimmy Uso came to the aid of his brother Jay. Roman Reigns nowhere to be found, obviously, because they already wrote him off television. He has multiple rib fractures after the heinous attack at Clash in Paris by Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed. That is who Jimmy saved Jay from at the end of the show on Monday. So it looks like we're heading towards Usos against Breakker and Reed at WrestlePalooza. Basically, they're running back the match they did at SummerSlam. The only difference is instead of Roman Reigns, you get a lesser star in Jimmy Uso. But the appeal here is that it's the Usos back together, right? One of the great tag teams in WWE in the last 20 years are going to be reunited most likely. And they can get some mileage out of that. You know, they can get some mileage out of an Usos reunion. So, I mean, that's a fine, mid-card match to have on that show. But then we have John Cena, who's very much not mid-card. John Cena was on SmackDown on Friday night. It was his final SmackDown. I did not know that until he said that on TV on Friday night. I knew it was his final Chicago appearance. They were in the very building where he debuted 23 years ago and shouted, "Ruthless Aggression!" at Kurt Angle. I don't know why I sounded like Vince McMahon there, but here he was, full circle moment, back in Chicago. First appearance, last appearance, but I did not know that it was also his final SmackDown. He will not be on SmackDown at all for the remainder of this retirement run. I tell you what, though, about Kurt Angle, I still get upset, though, when I think that we could have had one last Cena-Angle match at WrestleMania a few years ago. But Vince McMahon insisted on Baron Corbin instead. And it sucks we didn't get it. And you know what? It sucks that we're not going to get another Cena and Edge match. Because you know that if Edge was still in WWE, obviously Cena and Edge would be working together during this retirement run. And I think the two of them, just like Cena and Orton and Cena and Punk, I think the two of them could still have a very good match together. You know, maybe it wouldn't live up to some of the earlier matches they had. And that's not possible now. So that sucks. But Cena came out there and he said, "Look, I got no plan. I don't know what I'm going to say. I didn't think about it. I didn't plan for anything. I just wanted to come out here and just thank all of you and just take it all in." And he was ready to walk out when he was interrupted by Sami Zayn, the brand new United States champion who got booed out of the building. And I have no idea where that came from. That was surprising to hear the boos that loud for him. It's not like there's been any hint of fan backlash towards him in recent weeks. You know, even Cody, when he comes out, sometimes he'll get some mild boos here and there now. But this was just like boo, like thunderous boos, overwhelming Sami Zayn, who was, you know, he was laughing and smiling at it. But you know, that's just him masking, like, what the fuck is going on here? Because he didn't know what to say or how to react. But yes, he just won the United States Championship from Solo Sikoa, you know, a couple weeks ago. I don't know. Maybe it was just a matter of interrupting Cena in front of a very pro-Cena crowd. But Cena was about to leave anyway, so it's not like he interrupted him in mid-sentence. You know, it was just very weird. I'm assuming that was a one-night thing in Chicago and it's not going to carry over into other cities. But Zayn came out to mention how he made his main roster debut against John Cena. That was part of the John Cena U.S. Title Open Challenge that he was doing 10 years ago. Boy, a lot of commemorating things that happened 10 years ago. So he wanted two things. Number one, with Cena's permission, he wanted to revive the U.S. Title Open Challenge to extend opportunities to people just like Cena did to him. And Cena loved that idea. And two, he wanted to extend an invitation to John Cena the way that Cena did to him. John Cena against Sami Zayn in Chicago for the United States Championship. And Cena accepted. So we got an impromptu title match with John Cena on TV. It was a great match, too, what I actually saw of it. Because, unfortunately, they butchered the match with commercials more so than usual on these shows. And there were some big spots, too, that happened during those breaks. It's like a lot of these matches, when they have the commercial breaks or the picture-in-picture, you know, nothing of any significance happens. Like, I'll be watching Raw with the VPN, and so I can see, during Raw, I can see on Netflix, you know, what's going on during the breaks. And nothing terribly important ever happens, but they were popping off some pretty big spots, you know, during the commercial breaks during this match. There was a Blue Thunderbomb by Sami into a near fall on Cena. Later on, Cena got an ankle lock applied, and then the STFU. Sammy went for the ropes. Cena drags him back to the center of the ring, and it looks like the crowd is just going nuts in the background. But I can't hear a fucking thing. I can sure hear that BK theme. Sammy gave Cena an attitude adjustment later for a near fall. All of this happened during various commercials. We also got more callbacks to Cena's past opponents with him using the Kevin Owens pop-up powerbomb, the angle slam, which Michael Cole called a back suplex. I have no idea how Cole missed the significance of that spot in that building. He also referred to a John Cena spear, which was clearly an homage to Edge, as somehow a sign of his past battles with the big dog. Even Cena on Instagram the next morning, he posted a photo. You know, because Cena just posts photos. He doesn't post anything else. And a lot of times, you have to figure out the context. It didn't take much to figure out the context of this photo. He just posted a photo of Edge, standing in the corner, crouched down, setting up for a spear. I don't know what's going on with Michael Cole. He's been off lately. I don't know what's going on there. But in the end, a great U.S. title match ruined by Brock Lesnar, who came out, beat up the referee, F5 Sami Zayn, F5 John Cena, picked him up, F5'd him again. Then in the back, he told Cena that he would see him at WrestlePalooza, and he called him a bitch. Now, Brock is going to be back on SmackDown this Friday, so it'd be nice if he had a little more to say than that. You know, maybe talk about their history together, what it is about Cena that he clearly doesn't like. Remember when he cut that promo on Cena for their SummerSlam match and said that he was it the SummerSlam match or was it the Extreme Rules match? I don't remember now, but he cut that promo on Cena and he said that he was going to leave him in a pile of blood, urine, and vomit. Remember that? Kind of takes on a bit of a different meaning now, though. You know, did he want Cena to text him video of him urinating on the pile of blood and vomit? That we don't know. But just give us something more than just the bare minimum. Yeah, I know it's a big marquee match for them to promote, whether Brock says another word or not between now and then, but we still have 2 weeks to go. And now we know that John Cena is not going to be on SmackDown again. They told us already. He ain't going to be on SmackDown. So it would be nice to get something more than just a couple of sentences this Friday. Now, between the opening Cena promo and the match with Sammy, that ate up the first 45 minutes of the show on Friday. But it was the best part of the show outside of the ending. Now, I will say about SmackDown, you know, as much as everything in the middle felt like complete filler, and I'm not even going to rant again about the Julia stuff. If you want to hear my rant on that, go listen to my SmackDown review. But I will say that show flew by a lot faster than it does most weeks. It was more fun than SmackDown has been in weeks. They're also doing Randy Orton against Drew McIntyre this Friday, which smells like a Cody Rhodes return. And Tiffany Stratton defends the WWE Women's Championship against Jade Cargill. Nia Jax is still hanging around, so I don't know what involvement she may end up having there. I hope it's not her getting involved and they throw the match away and then we get a triple threat. Because I can totally see it being a triple threat. But back to Cena. We got some news. WWE has announced that John Cena will make his final appearances in Boston and New York City when Monday Night Raw comes to the TD Garden on November 10th and Madison Square Garden on November 17th. November 17th, that's interesting. WWE was at Madison Square Garden on November 17th in 1996 for the Survivor Series. It's where Sid won the title from Shawn Michaels. Don't ask me how I remember that. Some dates just stick with me. But what's interesting about that is that means Cena's final match in December on Saturday night's main event will not be taking place in Boston. According to John Alba of Sports Illustrated, WWE has been trying to push Cena's last match as a destination weekend, like they do for WrestleMania. So they'll have some other events around the event, like an Undertaker one-man show. He says Boston badly wanted that Saturday night's main event show, and officials there made a strong push for it. WWE and TKO wanted Cena's last match to be a major destination event, and doing that in December in Boston around the holidays isn't easy. But it was a bidding process from the beginning, and Boston simply lost out. He says that Boston went hard for it. It didn't come to pass, and they were very upset with how WWE communicated the bidding process with them and some of the demands in comparison to past events in Boston. Well, that's how the bidding process works. When there's demand for a big event, you're going to have to pay top dollar or sweeten the pot to make it more attractive to them. It sounds like Boston didn't step up, and now they're bitter about it. So instead, we now find out that Washington, D.C. is likely to be the site of John Cena's final match. And I was thinking about that and said, I cannot think of a single connection that John Cena specifically has to Washington, D.C., except that one of his greatest rivals just so happens to be from Washington, D.C. The same night that John Cena won his first WWE championship, this man won his first World Heavyweight Championship. And that would be Dave Bautista. Now, I am not saying that Bautista is going to be wrestling John Cena in his final match. Bautista is retired. When he says that he is retired, I believe him 100%. He wanted that match with Triple H. He got that match with Triple H. That was 6 years ago. He is not wrestling again. But if they can make it work with his schedule, I think it would be cool for him and very appropriate for him to be a part of that show in some way. You know, they were both part of that OVW class of 2002. Bautista made his SmackDown debut in May of that year. Cena made his SmackDown debut the following month. And their careers parallel each other in a lot of ways, right on into the success that they're having in Hollywood. So if they have any guests of honor in attendance that night, and I'm sure they will, and if they can make it work schedule-wise, he should be one of the people that's present in DC that night. There has been a WWE commentary shakeup. Michael Cole and Corey Graves opened up SmackDown on Friday night with Cole saying that he and Corey would be handling the announce duties on Friday nights for the coming months. And PW Insider is reporting that the plan is for Cole and Corey to remain on the Monday Night Raw shows as well. So for the time being, they are both going to be pulling double duty each week because it's the start of the college football season. You know, just like when Pat McAfee would disappear for a few months, Joe Tessitore is going to be doing the same because he's calling games on Saturdays. But the bigger surprise is that in that same PW Insider report, they said that Wade Barrett would be off the road going forward and that he will not be calling Raw. Now, Barrett later responded to the reports on Twitter and people kind of twisting that around to mean something that it really didn't mean. And he said, I usually ignore BS reports like this, but it's causing needless hate to be spewed towards people I work with. WWE have kindly given me a couple of weeks off for personal time, booked 9 months ago, and then I'm back to business as usual. A complete non-story, the end. So there you have it from the man himself. He is not going anywhere. He'll be back on TV before the end of the month. Some people thought that it might have to do with comments that Barrett made about Nikki Bella on the Clash in Paris pre-show, which were such a non-issue that I cannot believe this turned into a story this week. I'm still waiting for someone to tell me where the actual story is here. But what happened is, during the kickoff for Clash in Paris, Wade Barrett, Michael Cole, and Big E were standing around. They were discussing the Intercontinental Championship match between Nikki Bella and Becky Lynch. And Wade took issue with Bella calling Becky desperate to stay at the top. And instead, he said that Nikki was the desperate one. She was desperate to recapture the former glory that she once enjoyed back in her day, back in her era. And Barrett, you know, he started by praising Nikki for the work that she did back then, but some people took issue when he implied that she was, you know, rusty and didn't have it anymore. And Nikki was desperate to prove that she could still hang with this new generation. So Nikki addressed the comments on a new episode of her podcast, the Nikki and Brie show, saying that she wanted to speak with him at Raw, but she claimed that he avoided her. She said, I would like to have had a conversation with Wade Barrett. He avoided me on Monday, which was shocking because he always comes up and says hi to me. He tried to avoid making eye contact with me in the hallway. And I understand when you want to be a heel commentator and stuff, but then there's one thing of Michael Cole does this beautifully. This is why Michael Cole is one of the greatest commentators. He knows how to take a life story and put it into what we do because that is real. We don't go out there as robots or superheroes. We are actually professional athletes, and we go through real things, and we have to make that part of it. And honestly, it really doesn't bother me. I get it. I was watching the pre-show, and I saw what Wade was saying about me. I'm sitting there getting ready in the locker room like, that's fine. Evidently, it's not fine if she thought enough to bring it up on her podcast. Were there fans saying anything about this the night of Clash in Paris? Like, honestly, I didn't see anything about that. I mean, I didn't even hear what Wade said until yesterday. I hunted down the clip, and I'll just play it for you. I mean, it's less than 30 seconds. You tell me what I'm missing here, okay? This is Wade Barrett on the kickoff in character, as everyone is on these things, talking about Nikki Bella.
For me, Nikki Bella is someone I went through the developmental system with. I think she's fantastic. She was absolutely, for my money, the best of her era and did everything she could have possibly done. However, she is now trying to recapture former glories. When you talk about desperate, to me, the desperate one is Nikki Bella in this situation, desperate to prove she still has it against this new generation that have changed the game.
What am I missing? What am I missing here? Have wrestlers and wrestling fans gone that soft, that totally innocuous comments by a heel commentator? I mean, he didn't even say anything offensive there. He put her over and then played off of their storyline. Like, have we gotten to the point where if people don't find at least three things to be offended by in the course of the day, they don't know what to do with themselves? Like, do these people wake up and look in the mirror and ask themselves, you know, self, what can we be offended by today? I mean, it's ridiculous. Now, upon reading the comments that Nikki made, Barrett tweeted out, I had no idea Nicole felt this way, and I'm happy to have this conversation anytime she likes. I wish she would have brought it up when we said hello to each other at Raw, rather than via her podcast. I don't understand the avoiding claim at all. Simply not true. And a few hours later, the beef was squashed, and he tweeted, great news, fight fans. Nikki and I have spoken, we've smoothed things over, and I have graciously been allowed back into the Bella Army. Fully paid up member since FCW 2008. A difference of perspective to which we are all entitled. But to be clear, some of the personal abuse that gets sent to Nikki on here is reprehensible and completely out of line, so let's cut that out immediately. Yeah, you know, it's one thing to criticize her character or her matches. If you don't like her, that's fine. But people on social media go beyond that. They end up making it personal, thinking that, you know, they can say anything they want to because they're behind a keyboard. And, you know, I notice this a lot, not always, but a lot of the times, you know, it's the ones that have, like, if you look at their bio, it's like father of three or devout this or devout that, like, who end up saying the most vile shit. Like, that will never not be funny to me. Disturbing, but funny. So I will co-sign that, but I still fail to see what it was that he said that would have made her or any other member of the Bella Army upset. Like, after I got done listening to that segment, I legitimately thought that they cut off the actual offensive part. Maybe they edited it out. Like, that's it? Am I missing something here? But good for Corey Graves. You know, he went from being upset about being demoted from the main roster shows to NXT to now calling Raw and SmackDown for the next few weeks. And I was going to say, you know, worlds collide also because he's done commentary for the last two AAA shows, and he's been very good at it. Worlds Collide is coming up this Friday. So if he's calling SmackDown, he won't be calling Worlds Collide because Worlds Collide starts immediately after SmackDown ends. SmackDown is in Norfolk, Virginia this Friday. Worlds Collide is taking place in Las Vegas. So maybe they get Vic Joseph to do the show. The card for Worlds Collide is as follows. I think it's final at this point. In what they're dubbing a Lucha Showcase, La Parca, Octagon Jr., Nino Hamburguesa, and Mascarita Sagrada take on Joaquin Wilde, Cruz del Toro, Lince Dorado, and Mini Abismo Negro. I'm going to go with Team La Parca for the win. We have the AAA Latin American champion, El Hijo de Dr. Wagner Jr., defending against Dragon Lee, JD McDonough, and Ethan Page in a four-way match. I think Dr. Wagner Jr. over here just won the championship, right? He just beat Macias for it. Yeah, he ain't losing that title. Finn Balor and Roxanne Perez. Again, like, this is another one of those Triple H cards where at least here it makes sense because it's Worlds Collide. But, you know, we're also coming off Triple Mania where there were so many WWE names in the card. It's like, my goodness. But we have Finn Balor and Roxanne Perez take on Mr. Iguana and Lola Vice in a mixed tag team match. I'm going with Balor and Roxanne here. AAA Reina de Reinas Championship number one contenders match. Natalya takes on Fabi Apache. I guess this is a fallout from what we saw at the end of the title match at Triple Mania. I'm going with Natalya to become number one contender. And the AAA World Tag Team titles on the line. Psycho Clown and Pagano defend against Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods. And in the main event, the AAA Mega Champion, El Hijo del Vikingo. Maybe he'll get a better reception in Las Vegas than he did in... where were they? Were they in Mexico City for Triple Mania? I don't know if the Boo Birds will follow him to Sin City. We'll find out. But Vikingo is going to defend the championship against Dominic Mysterio. And my guess here is that we see AJ Styles yet again, even though we already saw him cost Dom the title once at Triple Mania. Their feud is obviously continuing, though. You know, now, had Dom dropped the Intercontinental title to AJ on Raw last week, or this past week, I would have picked Dom to go over here and win the championship, but I can't do that now. I think Vikingo is winning. See, on Monday, El Grande Americano, he got involved in the match with AJ and Dom. Slipped the metal plate under his mask, he headbutted AJ with it, and then that led to Dom retaining the title. So Dom has this understanding, this plan with Kaiser. Styles shows up, foils that plan, Vikingo hangs on, and he retains the title. That's how I see it going. If AJ is going to take the Intercontinental title off of Dominic, WrestlePalooza feels like the place to do it. That way you can do a title change on that first ESPN show. So don't be surprised to see that match added to the PLE. Now, as far as Worlds Collide, I'm not staying up for it that night. I will be live on YouTube, as usual, when SmackDown is over, and we will do the full review. We had a full house this past Friday. Big night on SmackDown. Hopefully that will carry over on the stream this coming week. And this is an interesting little anecdote here that I thought I would share. The Godfather was in attendance for Vince McMahon's 80th birthday party a few weeks ago. Said he had a great time on his Poddin' Ain't Easy podcast. Today I learned that The Godfather has his own podcast. I did not know that. He said he and his wife were invited guests for the celebration, which took place at the 5-star Baccarat Hotel in New York City. He noted that McMahon paid for everything for his guests, including the hotel rooms and a wide range of activities around the city, including tickets to a New York Yankees versus Boston Red Sox game. He said, I'm not going to mention everybody who was there, but of course, Taker was there, Kane was there, Bradshaw was there. We had a good time. Cena was there, Jelly Roll performed. I know Jerry Lawler was there because he posted a photo on his Instagram of him with some of the other wrestlers there and then took it down later because evidently they didn't want any of this to get out. So somebody got to Lawler and said, take that down. But, you know, you could see Drew McIntyre was there. Sheamus was there. The Miz and Maurice, Titus O'Neil. But Godfather says he ran into McMahon as he was entering the cocktail party. And he mentioned that Vince was wearing a suit that made both him and The Undertaker think of Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies. He says, I'm like, Vince, thank you for inviting me. And Vince goes,
Charles, I just want you to know there's nobody here that's not my true friend. I even invited Dr. Gordon to be here.
Freaking Dr. Gordon, man. Anyway, he says, I just do it to crack myself up. He says, we talked for a second, and then we walked in, but he had on, like, a Dr. Evil suit. I didn't want to say it to him first. First of all, he looked better than when I've seen pictures of him lately. He looks a lot better than that. He's walking a lot better. He introduced me to his girlfriend, or whatever she was. Yeah, whatever she was. Who knows what kind of arrangement that is? I don't want to know. But I thought, Dr. Evil, you're Dr. Evil. I go in, everybody, of course, is talking to Vince. Me and Taker and Kane are talking, and Vince walks away, and Taker goes, dude, Vince is looking like Dr. Evil. I'm like, dude, that's exactly what I was thinking. Vince McMahon being dressed up like Dr. Evil is perfectly on brand for Vince McMahon. I wouldn't even be surprised if he just saw Austin Powers for the first time, and he thought that it would be fashionable to dress up as Dr. Evil. But Godfather also shared that he decided to get a facial for the first time. Said, I get there, and I get in my own little room, and I get my little robe on, and my little foo-foo slippers. I open the door. The room across from me, the door opens up. Who is it? The Undertaker. And he says they looked at each other in disbelief before having a laugh. I go, facial? He... I'm sorry. He goes, yeah. I should clarify that he is referring to a spa treatment. Facial can have a very different meaning at a Vince McMahon party. The idea of Godfather asking Undertaker facial? Holy shit, that is one fanfic that I never want to read. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Did you know that there are over 18,000 titles on Netflix worldwide? Yet, if you live here where I am in the United States, you're only seeing about 7,000 of those titles. That's less than half. If you want to watch the other 11,000, you'll have to find them on another streaming service, and you pay for enough of those as it is. It's almost like paying a tariff just because you want to see a movie. Only difference is you have a way to get around these tariffs and get the full experience that you deserve, and that is with ExpressVPN. Netflix actually hides content from you. Believe this? They hide content from you based on your location. ExpressVPN allows you to change your virtual location so that you control where you want Netflix to think you're located. They have servers in over 100 countries in all 50 states, so you can gain access to thousands of new shows and movies and never run out of stuff to watch. You can just keep adding to your playlist. And it's not just Netflix that it works with. You can use it with other streamers like Disney Plus and BBC iPlayer and more. ExpressVPN is the best VPN because it's easy to use. With a simple tap of a button in the app, you can change your location. If you ever wish that you could just teleport somewhere, how much easier that would be? You no longer need to wonder. You can now. It's also blazing fast with zero buffering when you stream in HD, and it works across all of your devices. Phones, laptops, tablets, smart TVs, you name it. There's a reason ExpressVPN is ranked number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. Two of my favorite movies of all time are The Shawshank Redemption and The Dark Knight. And a lot of you know about The Dark Knight because I talk about it a lot. I can't watch either one of them on Netflix in the US right now. How ridiculous is that? But with my ExpressVPN, I tap one button to connect to a server in Australia. And I'm watching Shawshank again. I mean, I'm running around with the kangaroos and stuff, and I'm watching Shawshank Redemption on my phone. It worked like a charm. The Dark Knight. I could watch that movie over and over again, never get bored of it. Not on Netflix here. But when I connected to a server in Japan, I got me some Batman and Joker. I always wanted to visit Japan. This may be as close as I ever get, but at least now I have access to my favorite movie. And again, it's super easy. I just open the ExpressVPN app. I type in Japan. The server comes up. I click one button to connect to it. And in less than 3 seconds, I'm transported halfway across the world. Then I just refresh my Netflix and the movies are there. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/Solomonster. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/Solomonster to get an extra 4 months of ExpressVPN for free. As WWE continues to load up the WrestlePalooza card for September 20th, Tony Khan made the only decision that he could if he was going to make any kind of move to help maximize the audience for All Out, which was to move the time of the pay-per-view up, and that's exactly what he did. Basically, WWE said, I dare you. And Tony blinked, but it was the right move to make. All Out will now air at 3 p.m. Eastern time and not the originally scheduled 8 p.m. Eastern from Toronto to avoid what would have been a very costly head-to-head battle that they would have lost. Let's just be honest. The sickos may be watching no matter what, but there are other fans who watch both who are now forced to make a choice. And Tony decided it simply wasn't worth it to risk losing hundreds of thousands of dollars in pay-per-view money. Not to mention the fact that All Out will be AEW's pay-per-view debut on HBO Max, which I will be getting to here in a minute. If you want to get as many people as possible tuning into that first pay-per-view on Max, WWE was not going to make that easy. I mean, as it is, there's still going to be some overlap because WrestlePalooza starts at 7 Eastern. And it's going to be a cold day in hell before Tony Khan ends an AEW pay-per-view after just 4 hours. Okay, so that ain't going to happen. So either the main event or the final two matches are going to go head-to-head with the start of the WWE show. But this was a business decision, pure and simple. Anyone beating up on Tony Khan for doing this or mocking him for tucking tail and running, like, it was a smart business decision. Fightful is also saying that after the success of Forbidden Door airing in the afternoon, that contributed to their decision to move the start time of the show. I mean, it may have made them feel better about the decision to move the show, but that is not the reason they moved All Out. No matter what anybody says, that is not the reason that All Out moved. Now, AEW afternoon shows are, for me anyway, so much better because, again, Tony insists on loading these shows up to the gills, which means marathon shows. And while they are still too long most of the time, they're a lot more tolerable in the afternoon going long than they are if they were to go long at night. Right. And if you would like to go long at night like AEW, you need Blue Chew. You know, I'm offended that they've never reached out to me in all these years to be a sponsor. Like, I really am. But no, the length of those shows, they're just obnoxious. So watching them in the afternoon is preferable for me. For me, as a fan and as a content creator, I love it. See, because now I'll be able to watch most of the AEW show live, and I'm going to go right into WrestlePalooza, which I will review that night, and I'll save my All Out review for the sound off on Sunday. You know, now who this is not so good for are the fans who already bought tickets for the show and now they can't go. For whatever reason, they have to work during the day, they have other plans, even worse if they're not local and they're flying in for the show. If you can't make the show, I'm sure you can get a refund on whatever you paid for your ticket. Same for your hotel. Actually, with your hotel, you're usually not billed until that week anyway. But that may not be the case for your flight, unless you paid for a refundable ticket or tickets. If you're going with friends or family, those people just got fucked. And they have every right to be upset. Thankfully, I'm not one of those people. So it's okay with me. But because of the all-out time change, Collision will only be an hour that week, and it's going to be airing on Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, immediately following Dynamite. It's going to be a three-hour block they're calling September to Remember. Boy, ECW be getting all the love from all the major companies this month, huh? AEW trademarked the name back on April 18th. It is a play off the old ECW November to Remember pay-per-view. Tony Khan was a huge ECW fan back in the day, which is one of the reasons they just finished a residency at the 2300 Arena last night. Tony had been there with his dad when he was a teenager in 1996. This was his first time back in the building in almost three decades. So that's one programming change. Another change is that TNT is airing an hour called AEW Saturday Tailgate Brawl at 2 p.m. the day of All Out. So an hour before the pay-per-view starts, that will be the last hour of their zero-hour pre-show. So it'll be the first time that the Zero Hour, or part of it, airs live on television. And I'm looking at this and I'm reading all of this stuff and I'm just like, man, if you're a wrestling fanatic, if you're a wrestling savant, and you want to watch everything that day, that Zero Hour is probably starting at 1:30 in the afternoon. If you watch all of the AEW content and you go right into the WWE show, that's over 9 straight hours of wrestling. I don't know why anybody would do that, but I'm sure there are some people who will. Now, the other big AEW announcement had to do with them finally airing their live pay-per-views on HBO Max in the United States. Max will not be the exclusive home of all AEW pay-per-views. You will still be able to buy the show on other platforms like Amazon Prime and YouTube. But starting with All Out, you can buy the pay-per-views at a discounted rate of $39.99 per show on HBO Max. That is on top of your subscription fee for Max itself. So this is not a Peacock deal where you just subscribe to HBO Max and you get all the pay-per-views for no additional charge. And that was never the case. Nobody should have thought that would be the case. They made very clear last year that was not how this was going to work. Only that you would be able to buy the shows at some sort of discount. On other platforms, they charge $50 for the show. At least here in the U.S. they do. If you don't already subscribe to HBO Max and you don't plan to use it for anything except the pay-per-views, the so-called discount really isn't. It really just offsets the fee for the most basic subscription tier, which comes with ads. So it's really not much of a discount at all. Basically, there's three tiers here. The basic tier with ads is $9.99 a month or $99.99 a year. The standard tier is $16.99 a month, and the premium tier is $20.99 a month. Now, if you use Max to watch Dynamite and Collision, or decide to use Max from now on to watch the weekly shows, then it's worth it if that means you can ditch cable or satellite. But if you're still paying for cable just to watch AEW, and I don't know how many people fall into that category, but let's say you are one of those people, you need to stop doing that immediately. Like, what the hell is wrong with you? I would hope that you're watching other things on there. Otherwise, I don't know how you can justify still paying for cable. But then you add in the archives, if that's something that you're interested in, going back and watching the glory days of Dynamite and the older pay-per-views, then it's worth it because of all the additional content that you'll have access to. But I think that $39.99 price point is a big misfire, especially for the first show on Max. Like, I said this on TNT on Tuesday night before all of this was even announced. I would have even considered offering All Out for free, only to people who watch on HBO Max. That was before I said this before they moved the start time of the show to avoid WWE. If they were still going head-to-head with WWE as sort of a nice fuck you to them, I would have done something like that as a way to entice people to subscribe to Max if they're not already on there. Tony would have taken a big hit on his pay-per-view money, though. So he may not have felt like it was worth it. I'm just looking at it from the perspective of if he wanted to make the best possible impression on his partners at Warner Brothers Discovery and try to maximize that audience on Max and really impress them, that would have been the move to make. And then going forward, I would have priced the shows at $30 per show. That would be $20 less than what you would pay elsewhere. And that's a much bigger savings without giving away the store, which is what it would have been. Yeah, if you did it at $20 or $25, sure, that would have been great. Saving $10 a month over the course of a year is a savings of $120, which is not an insignificant amount of money. But I think pricing them out at $40 a pop is just a missed opportunity. Now, who made the call? Was it Tony Khan? Was it Warner Brothers Discovery? I doubt very seriously that it was a unilateral call by Tony Khan himself. So who knows how much say he had in that price point. But for the people who were upset that they have to pay anything at all, I think a lot of us were spoiled by the WWE Network. You know, when the network launched in 2014, being able to get all the pay-per-views, including WrestleMania, all for just $9.99 a month. Plus, on top of that, you got the library, which was a big deal to a lot of people. And it just immediately made pay-per-view obsolete for a lot of fans. It's the same thing with Peacock. You just take for granted that you are paying for a Peacock subscription and you can just log in and watch WrestleMania. You know, antiquated as the pay-per-view model may be, it's the lifeblood of AEW. I mean, outside of their media rights money, it's the lifeblood of AEW. AEW has always operated under a pay-per-view model. They make a lot of money on pay-per-view. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions even. And then each platform gets a cut, so that doesn't mean that AEW gets millions of dollars off every show all for themselves. But think about it, at $49.99 per show, right? All in Texas, was said to be somewhere in the range of 180 to 185,000 pay-per-view buys. That's over $9 million in pay-per-view revenue, with another $3 million in gate revenue. And you wonder why AEW still does pay-per-views. That's why. It is still a lucrative business for them. So you consider that and the fact that they signed a $600 million media rights deal with Warner. One thing you can't say about AEW is that the company isn't generating income. Now, are they turning a profit? Are they spending more than they're taking in? That's a different question. But they know how to generate money off these pay-per-views. One thing they did not generate much of this week was a television audience. It was a terrible week in general for wrestling ratings on TV. Raw did a record low audience, apparently, on Netflix. But it also aired 6 hours earlier than usual because they were in France. So I don't really put a lot of stock into that. SmackDown the week before aired on a 5 hour tape delay. But I mean, it's not like tape shows always do this badly. SmackDown did not do well that week. The Clash in Paris go home show that week did just 1.1 million viewers on USA Network, which for WWE is not a great number. Dynamite, though, this past week did far worse. And I don't talk much about the ratings in general, but I don't talk much about the Dynamite ratings anymore because there's really no point in doing so, since everyone will just point to Max and assume that they must be doing 5 million people on HBO Max, so everything is all fine and dandy. But I can't not talk about this. Dynamite did its lowest numbers ever in the history of the show on its regular date and time. And that is without knowing what they're doing on HBO Max, but I don't care what they're doing on HBO Max. I promise you, that does not explain why the show took a fucking nosedive this week on TBS, other than people just didn't give a shit about Dynamite this week. Something about the show turned them off in a way that it hasn't turned them off before, because I have never seen a Dynamite number this low before on a Wednesday night. It just never happened before. They did just 472,000 viewers on TBS. That is a 20% drop from the week prior. 0.11 in the 18 to 49 demo, which is the second lowest number in the history of the show, regardless of the day and time. And there was nothing on television that night that would explain that kind of drop. That's coming off Collision doing its lowest numbers in the history of the show. They did just 195,000 viewers on TNT last weekend, excluding Max numbers. But at least there they had college football competition, which is a very legitimate thing to point to because it's college football season. So they're going to take a hit. And it looks just like WWE is going to take a big hit from Monday Night Football. We go through this every single year in September. That's the reason why Netflix is bumping up the start time for Raw. Not tomorrow night, but for the next 3 weeks after that. The show starts at 7 Eastern instead of 8. But none of this explains the Dynamite collapse this week. And look, the ratings don't dictate your level of enjoyment of the shows. If you are liking what you are seeing on Wednesday nights, then these numbers, they don't matter to you. But they do matter to the people who run the show and air the show. Right? There are some important people who do pay attention to this kind of stuff. And I can tell you just from personal experience, I feel it on Wednesday nights when I talk about Dynamite too. And the audience that's, you know, there for those streams relative to the streams on Mondays and Fridays. And God knows SmackDown hasn't been great for a while now. I mean, forget this week, but it's a noticeable difference, you know, when you look at Wednesdays as opposed to Mondays and Fridays. And that's one small sample size, but I see it. At the end of the day, it comes down to creative and giving people a product that they want to tune into. And when those numbers drop and there's no external factor to point to explain it away, you need to look from within. I don't know if Tony has the capacity to do that. He likes what he likes, and he thinks Dynamite is better than ever. He thinks it's the best it's ever been. The numbers say otherwise. The attendance says otherwise. I said this months ago, if there really is some kind of big turnaround with the product, because Tony has made comments about how, you know, everything's on the rise and things are great and things are better than ever. Well, you know what? If that's true, then it should be reflected in the attendance, first and foremost. And them starting to run bigger buildings again for their weekly shows, that would be a telltale sign. That will be the key sign. Because if they think that they're ready to pack in 5 or 6 or 7,000 people a week in bigger venues, they would already be doing it. Here we are 5 months later, since I first heard these comments being made about how great everything is. 5 months later, and they're still running small venues and getting 1,000 fans, 2,000 fans a week. They don't have the confidence to run those bigger buildings like they used to. They don't. They do for their pay-per-views. They can put 10,000 people in a building for All Out, no problem. Or 20,000 in the O2 in London for Forbidden Door, no problem. Or 30,000 at Globe Life Field in Texas for All In, no problem. That's never really been an issue for them, but it's those weekly shows that people just don't care enough about to buy a ticket to go see. I know a lot of AEW fans, they don't like hearing that. They think that AEW can do no wrong. But tell me when I'm telling lies. You know, the 2300 Arena, it's a nice slice of history for a week or two. Arena Mexico, right? That Grand Slam show back in June, that was great. It looked great on television. It sounds like they're probably going to do another residency in December at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. That's great. Where's the Kia Forum? Where's the Prudential Center in Newark? Where are some of these places that they have run multiple times for Dynamite in the past? It's been a while since they've run there. How come they haven't gone back? It's because they don't have the confidence that they can do it in those buildings now like they did back then. Which is not to say that they were selling them out then, but that's the thing that I've been looking for. When do they start running venues like that again on a regular basis? You know, when does it make sense to run those buildings again? It makes sense to run the more intimate, smaller venues if they know they cannot fill up the bigger ones. You know, some of them come across really well on TV and they look cool. That's great. I wish WWE would do that from time to time. But like WWE running Hammerstein, that would be a trip. But it makes no sense right now. When they could promote Nick Khan taking a dump in the middle of the ring and their fans are still going to buy up those tickets, 12,000 fucking tickets at prices 500% higher than they used to be, they're not going to run the smaller venues because it doesn't make any sense for them to do so. But the question has to be asked, why are those people who were buying tickets before not buying them now? Are they asking those questions? Do they even care? AEW was back at the 2300 Arena for Dynamite on Wednesday, which ended with a major injury angle to write Kenny Omega off television for a while. It was Kenny Omega, Hangman Page, and Jet Speed against Kyle Fletcher, Josh Alexander, and the Young Bucks. That ended with Fletcher pinning Kevin Knight to win it for the Don Callis family. After the match, they had Fletcher suplex Kenny off the apron through a table, which, I mean, maybe 30 years ago would be a six-month layoff. But in today's wrestling, both men would normally beat the count back into the ring by 9. Here, though, they used the suplex through a table as a way to write Omega off TV. That was my impression watching it, and that they were setting up for Kyle Fletcher to challenge Hangman Page at All Out for the AEW World Championship. And I had some people in the comments on Wednesday telling me, no, they're setting up Fletcher and Omega for All Out. But that would mean Omega would have to be back on TV within the next 2 weeks, which would be very dumb. Last night on Collision, they did in fact confirm that it will be Kyle Fletcher challenging Hangman Adam Page. The TNT champion has called out the AEW World Champion for an AEW World Championship match at All Out. And now we also get reports from Fightful and the Wrestling Observer that confirm Kenny Omega is taking time away to care for a few things or take care of a few things. One of which, according to Fightful, is the Tokyo Game Show. And that is a gaming festival that kicks off September 25th. Fightful says the break is not injury-related, but Meltzer is reporting that he is going to Japan to also see some of his doctors there. Also to get his Japanese visa updated and to do other media, including to talk about Hiroshi Tanahashi, who is retiring, of course, at the Tokyo Dome on January 4th. So this would be the second straight all-out pay-per-view that Omega has missed. His last all-out was 2023. That was when he lost to Konosuke Takeshita. Omega responded to the reports and the idea of him taking, quote, time off. He took issue with that phrasing, saying, time off? Specialized hospital visits and work that had been planned for a year, but sure, let's bait the trolls. I'm just trying to improve what I can and represent the company in a positive way while not performing. Don't be misleading with headlines, please, and thank you. On Dynamite this Wednesday, Hangman is wrestling Josh Alexander in what they are billing as a grudge match. Alexander has now won three straight all-star eight-man tags, getting the winning fall in two of the three. Tony does love his all-star matches. And, you know, look, it's bad enough that they have the competition from Wrestlepalooza that day to deal with, and they felt they had to move the pay-per-view up by 5 hours. But they were already going in with a handicap because they're without Will Ospreay, they're without Swerve Strickland, and now they won't even have Kenny Omega. That's three of their top babyfaces who will not be on the show. That's a tough deal. But confirmed so far for the pay-per-view is Adam Copeland and Christian Cage against FTR, Ricochet and the Gates of Agony against Bobby Lashley, Shelton Benjamin, and MVP. Mercedes Moné will defend her TBS championship against Riho. Yes, the same Riho that has not wrestled a match since July of last year when she broke her wrist on Collision. Shows up and gets awarded a TBS championship match. Not that any of this matters. She's just another victim for Mercedes to conquer on her road to 509 days as the TBS champion. She's at 470 right now. She needs to get to 509 to become the longest reigning TBS champion of all time, which will happen. We just had Athena past 1,000 days as the Ring of Honor Women's Champion. When you get that close, the record will fall. And also confirmed now, after Collision last night, there was a women's... it must have been an all-star match. I'd be shocked if Tony didn't bill it as an all-star match, but there was a women's tag match last night involving the Triangle of Madness, and Tony Storm was there, and Chris Statlander, and... Anyway, we are getting a four-way match because I've been wondering who the hell is Toni Storm going to defend her women's world title against at All Out. They haven't set anybody up for it. Well, now we know it's going to be a four-way match for the AEW Women's World Championship with Toni Storm defending against Jamie Hayter, Chris Statlander, and Tekla, which sounds like an excellent match. I can't hate on that. Jamie Hayter and Toni Storm should have been a long-term singles direction. With any hope, it still will be. I was not expecting them to be in the ring together on this pay-per-view. But you take those four women and put them in the ring together, and that should be a hell of a match. And I'll tell you what, I wouldn't be shocked to see a title change there. I really wouldn't. And of all the people in that match who could potentially take that championship from Toni Storm, I got my eye on Chris Statlander. Now, we know the Death Riders have been trying to recruit her. I think she actually won that match last night with the Wheeler Yuta seatbelt pin. And again, you know, I really hope we're not seriously considering adding new members to the Death Riders. I mean, it doesn't do anything for me, that group, at this point. But if they want to put a spotlight on Chris Statlander and possibly put that championship on her and give her a run with it, I can get behind that. If Tony was to lose, she's the one who I think would walk out of that match with that championship. Now, we also knew coming into Collision last night that Mark Briscoe was going to be wrestling Konosuke Takeshita, right? He already beat Lance Archer. He had to beat Takeshita to earn the right to challenge Kyle Fletcher for the TNT Championship. Once Kyle Fletcher threw down the gauntlet to Hangman Page for a world championship match at All Out, it kind of gave away the fact that we weren't getting Kyle Fletcher and Mark Briscoe. So they kind of, in a way, they kind of spoiled it. But I told you, when we talked about Dynamite on Wednesday, for the people that were with me for the review, I said they're going to do this match on Collision. This is probably where MJF is going to show up. And this is where MJF is going to cost Mark Briscoe. And he is not going to beat Takeshita, which means he is not getting a TNT championship match with Kyle Fletcher, because he was never going to get a TNT title match with Kyle Fletcher. And MJF is an interesting one because he is defending his CMLL title against Mystico the night before All Out at Arena Mexico. And I fully expect he will be losing that championship at Arena Mexico. So he's going to be traveling from Arena Mexico late that Friday to get to Toronto for the pay-per-view, which is now rescheduled for earlier in the day on Saturday, which is not impossible, but that's going to be a bit of a travel day for him. But MJF just got married this past Friday to Alicia Atoute. Tony Khan was at the wedding, as were many names from the AEW roster. I did see the Hangman hiding in the background. The Ring of Honor Death Before Dishonor pay-per-view that just took place was originally scheduled for September 5th. And then, this was back in July, it suddenly got moved. And I think this was before tickets went on sale, but they moved it back a week to August 29th. And no reason was given at the time, other than there was an item in the Observer where Meltzer said that Tony Khan had never missed the TV before. And it would have been impossible for him to be at the show because he had a wedding that he was committed to. So he just decided to move the entire pay-per-view. Now we know whose wedding it was. It was fucking MJF's wedding. So that's why Death Before Dishonor got moved. But yes, now MJF and Mark Briscoe, they are going to be wrestling it All Out. Mark Briscoe, I believe, is going to be able to pick the stipulation. He did not name what that stipulation would be on Collision, but I believe we'll find out on Dynamite this Wednesday. So we are getting at least one more battle between MJF and Mark Briscoe. It's fine. I mean, there's no need to rush right back into Hangman and MJF. MJF still has that Casino Gauntlet contract, although he does have to give at least a week's notice when he's ready to cash it in. I still think he may well hold off until World's End. I think they might try to hold off until the end of the year. I know we still have Wrestle Dream and then Full Gear, you know, and I could definitely see that being the match of Full Gear. Full Gear or World's End? I say World's End just because World's End is the event 2 years ago where MJF lost the championship. So maybe him winning it back on that show would be kind of poetic. But, you know, if they want to do MJF and Briscoe and blow it off, I have no issue with it. Again, there was a report a few months ago that MJF personally requested a program, wanted to work with Mark Briscoe. It was important that he work with Mark Briscoe. So he's getting the chance to work with Mark Briscoe. You know, that's what he wanted, and he still has that contract in his back pocket. They'll circle back around to it when the time is right. Hangman and Kyle Fletcher, you know, look, I think Kyle Fletcher is going to be an even bigger star for them. I think they've done a very good job with him as far as building him up from, I don't want to say nobody, you know, but he was a tag team wrestler. You know, he was one half of Aussie Open. And so to go from that to where he is now, you can't say that he hasn't transformed himself physically, but also his career, he has turned into one of the fastest rising stars in this company. I look at him, I look at Takeshita, who both happen to be members of the same faction, but he's, you know, he's right there with those guys. You know, he's going to be a top-tier performer for them for many years to come. And so him getting a match with Hangman, I'm sure the quality of the match is going to be very good. I don't see that as being a match that's going to really entice people into buying the pay-per-view. A lot of it is going to come down to what the full card looks like. I just don't see people buying this show. Oh, it's going to be Kyle Fletcher wrestling Hangman for the championship. And I'm sure he's got a real shot of winning that title too. Nobody believes that. So it's not the strongest challenger for Hangman, which is why I would have been okay with them doing a tag match and not even having a title match on the show. If they would have done something like Hangman and Kenny against Takeshita and Okada, I think that would have been a great match to do. But I guess Omega, he may have had to be in Japan. It may not have been possible, you know, for him to be on that show. It's probably a scheduling thing. Also, on that Collision show last night, they inserted a backstage promo with Big Bill and Brian Keith. And Bill said that his life hit rock bottom in the 2300 arena. He said the fans mocked him, laughed at him. He said the Philadelphia fans showed their true colors. He said Philadelphia is where players spit on their opponents and steal foul balls from children and have a statue for their only hero who is a fictional character. And he said he comes from a place where real tough guys are made. New York City. That's right. Bill said there's another guy from New York City who claims to be a tough guy, but he hasn't heard from him or seen him in a long time. I'm officially calling you out, Eddie Kingston. This is how they set up the return of Eddie Kingston. Eddie Kingston's been gone for well over a year. We got Big Bill out here just randomly spouting off about a guy who hasn't been on television in 15 months, 16 months. Not the way that I would have brought Eddie Kingston back. It really is too bad, though, that they just couldn't work it out, I guess, where Eddie came back to make the save for Darby a few weeks ago or to do something with Gabe Kidd, who was just on TV. But we saw, last we saw Gabe Kidd on Wednesday, Darby put him in a body bag and literally dragged him out of the building. And I've seen or heard something where Kid may already be back in Japan. He may not even be, on TV for a while. So that may not have been possible, but I don't know. I mean, of all the ways to bring back Eddie Kingston, this is certainly a pretty lazy way to do so, but at least he's coming back. It's good that he's coming back. I really hope they can elevate him to something, decent, something important on the show to do. There are people on the show, there are stories that he can be involved with that would actually make a lot of sense, people he has history with. If this is just their way of reintroducing him, getting him a win his first night back, and then they transition him into, something with the Death Riders or something like that, then that's fine. But just the way they set this up was just very strange. It felt like maybe this is an all-out match. It's a way to get Eddie, back in the ring at All Out for the first time. So at least he's on his way back. At least now we know he is coming back imminently. And I mentioned the announcer shakeup in WWE before. There is a new addition to the AEW announce team starting this week on Dynamite. Bryan Danielson becomes a member of the commentary team on a full-time basis moving forward. The announcement was made on Twitter by Tony Khan, who did not specify if it will now be a four-man booth, which would be completely unnecessary, or if someone is moving out of the booth. I think keeping it a three-man booth is fine. Tony Schiavone is already handling the play-by-play on Collision every week. I don't think he needs to be on Dynamite. Dynamite has a play-by-play guy. They want to go with Excalibur. That's their choice. Fine. If Excalibur is going to be their play-by-play guy, I don't see the need to have Tony Schiavone on commentary doing Dynamite color or play-by-play or anything else. He can be the guy who stands in the ring on Dynamite with the microphone or on stage with the microphone and conducts interviews where 95% of the time the person just pulls the microphone out of his hand anyway and tells him to go sit down. But that could be his role on Wednesdays, and let Schiavone continue to do play-by-play on Collision. He's really not needed in that booth anymore on Wednesdays. You could have Excalibur, Taz, and Bryan Danielson. They had Danielson doing commentary for Forbidden Door. And I liked his commentary. I think it's a good role for him to be in. Other news and notes. We got a bunch of them here. In a story that could have had potential implications on pro wrestling, since independent contractors were included in the list of those affected by this, the Federal Trade Commission announced that it is moving to vacate its rule banning non-compete agreements, which are employment agreements that prevent workers from taking new jobs with a competing business or starting one of their own, usually within a certain geographic area and time frame after leaving their job. The ban, championed by former FTC chair Lina Khan, was finalized in 2024, but never took effect, following a lawsuit brought by the Dallas-based tax services firm Ryan LLC. A federal judge in Texas found that the FTC had likely exceeded its authority in issuing the ban and halted it nationwide. Last fall, the administration appealed that ruling to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, But in March, the new administration asked the court for a four-month pause on the appeal. Then in July, they told the court they needed more time still. The court approved another 60-day pause that was to end on September 8th. Late Friday afternoon, just ahead of that deadline, the FTC announced that it had voted 3-1 to dismiss the appeal and take steps to vacate the rule entirely. The rule would have covered not only employees, but independent contractors, interns, and volunteers. So in WWE, if your contract expires, you're free and clear to go work wherever you want. But if they release you, either because you asked to be released or they just decided we don't want you anymore, we're going to get rid of you. If you're an NXT star, you typically have a 30-day non-compete. For main roster talents, it's 90 days that you sit at home and you get paid until that period of time is up. And until then, you are not allowed to go wrestle somewhere else, like an AEW or even independence. I mean, maybe if you ask nicely, they might let you, but you can't just, like, if you're released, right? I just got my release from WWE. I got the phone call, right? You're not picking up that phone the next day and calling Tony Khan. Like, legally, you are not allowed to do that. You can't even negotiate with them. You're basically on ice for up to 3 months. And some wrestlers might be okay with sitting at home and getting paid to do nothing but train, right? And plot and plan their next moves. But they might like having the option of going to work somewhere else. Maybe they had a lot of buzz around them and they're worried that by sitting at home and doing nothing, it's all going to evaporate. Maybe they just want to work. Even if this rule had gone into effect, like if I was WWE, I'm not saying this is what I would do, but if I was WWE, I wouldn't release anybody early unless it was for some sort of disciplinary reason, unless I just really didn't want to pay them to not use them. I could see WWE just holding on to people until their deals expire. Tony Khan. So they probably would have found their way around it with some ridiculous loophole like that. But it's all a moot point now because the FTC is vacating the rules, so there will be no national ban on non-compete agreements after all. The new chair of the FTC has claimed that he is no fan of non-compete agreements and that instead of a national ban, he would look to send FTC enforcers out looking for non-competes that violate the Sherman Act, which is an 1890 law prohibiting activities that restrict competition in the marketplace. Meanwhile, the FTC only has around 1,400 employees total to actually police the entire economy. Good luck enforcing that. I love this idea that they're going to send us like a small posse out of enforcers to go look for non-competes. Maybe there's one hiding in that bush over there. I think I saw a non-compete hiding behind the dumpster at the Chick-fil-A near me. Yeah, this is dead. WWE and AEW have nothing to worry about. I don't even know if AEW uses non-compete clauses in their contracts since Tony lets them take bookings independently. I mean, maybe they have something in there that applies specifically to WWE. I don't know. No need for a non-compete, though, when you can just bench someone indefinitely until their contract expires. This is a scary story as it relates to Liv Morgan's stalker. Remember this piece of work? This comes from PW Insider. The U.S. government filed a motion this week attempting to prevent Sean Chan, the Canadian man charged with one count of interstate domestic violence against WWE star Liv Morgan, after traveling to the U.S. and spending hours loitering at her property in Florida, trying to stop him from being released from incarceration before his trial, which is expected to take place this November. Chan filed a motion on August 20th asking the court to reconsider his being held without bail through the trial. The filing said his attorneys have secured a Salvation Army location that Chan can reside in until the trial takes place. In a motion this week, prosecutors noted the defendant is a danger to the community, a serious risk of flight, and there are no conditions of release that will reasonably assure Chan's appearance at further proceedings of this case. The United States requests that Chan remain detained pending trial. They also argued that His defense, having secured Chan a bed at the local Salvation Army, does not meet the legal requirement for Chan to have his incarceration status reconsidered, arguing the fact that counsel has secured a bed for him at the Salvation Army does not have a material bearing on the issue of whether there are conditions of release that will reasonably assure his future appearance and the safety of other persons and the community. The nature and circumstances of his offense, the weight of the evidence against him, and Chan's history and characteristics justify detention. This newly proffered information does not have a material bearing on the issue of whether there are conditions of release that will reasonably assure his appearance at future court proceedings and the safety of other persons in the community, including Liv Morgan. And they didn't say Liv Morgan, but they're referring to Liv Morgan. That'd be funny if they just used WWE names here in the court documents. They argue that should Chan be set free through trial, not only is there nothing holding him from being a flight risk, but he could easily attempt to visit Morgan's home again. It was also revealed that when Chan left a note at Morgan's home, he left his name, Canadian address, and phone number. The government also argued Chan's history and characteristics also demonstrate that he is a very real risk of non-appearance. To begin, Chan is a Canadian citizen who was only in the Middle District of Florida to intimidate and stalk Liv Morgan. He has no reported family in the Middle District of Florida. He does not have a job in the Middle District of Florida, nor does he have any authorization to work in the United States. In fact, Chan has no obvious ties to this country at all. Instead, his only contacts appear to be in Canada, where he could easily flee if released. What's more, at the initial detention hearing, Chan reported having no mental health problems. Since then, however, Chan's counsel has indicated that Chan is being evaluated for competency. Given Chan's lack of ties to the community and these serious mental health concerns, there is no condition or combination of conditions that can reasonably assure Chan's appearance at trial. And it goes on here. There's some more information in here. It's just, this guy's just completely just disturbed. As PW Insider reported earlier this week, Chan had previously signed a waiver of speedy trial in order, according to court records, to allow adequate time to conduct a psychiatric evaluation of the defendant. Chan flew from Scarsborough, Ontario to Orlando, Florida on May 26th, telling customs agents in Florida that he would be staying at the WWE Performance Center, which has no housing facilities. 4 days later, according to the criminal complaint against him, Chan traveled several hours to Liv Morgan's home, circled her property several times, and entered through her backyard. He then attempted to gain entry to her front door, but was unsuccessful. He found and held an air pellet that was sitting inside her front porch, and after waiting several hours, left a note and departed. According to the criminal complaint against him, Chan's note read in part, "It's me, Sean, the guy you all hang out with on," and then it says gaming platform deleted, "online. You've been trying to contact me, or should I say reach out to me when I'm absent from that game. So who's the stalker, huh? I never said and did anything bad for over 10 years, yet you all dared hating me for no reason. I came here to pay just a friendly visit, nothing more. Yet I'm the one who looks like a stalker thanks to all of you. You think I'm going to have empathy, sympathy, and care about any of you anymore? I will start talking and doing whatever I want, despite all your shoosh finger faces that you all make. Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that I was here." That is just fucking scary. Chan was arrested by the FBI on June 3rd after WWE security, having seen security footage from Morgan's home, recognized him and alerted authorities. Chan was indicted on June 25th and faces 5 years in prison. The court has yet to rule on Chan's request to be released. As of this writing, he remains incarcerated in Hernando County, Florida. Let us hope, for the sake of all involved, including Liv Morgan, that this creep stays incarcerated where he belongs for the time being. That is just... Yeah, I just got done talking last week about the Rhea Ripley thing and how she got swarmed when she was in France. And there have been other incidents that have taken place. And it looks like WWE is, in certain situations, at least now sending security out with some of the women when they're on the road at some of these venues. But there are people online who are just, and a lot of it is with the women who are just completely obsessed. I mean, you see this type of obsessive behavior just in the way that people tweet and comment about certain things. And that's one thing. But when you take it to that next level and you do something like this, or the Sonya Deville stalker who went to her house. We talked about that story too, when he had zip ties and I think weapons, and God only knows what he was planning on doing to that woman. That was a terrifying situation. She had to take time off from WWE and you know, deal with that whole situation because it was a traumatic situation. You know, at what point do we have a story that, you know, has an ending that is going to be tragic? I mean, I hope it doesn't happen, but you know, you have people out there who are like this, who obviously are mentally compromised in some way and need help. And this is what you end up with. You end up with situations like this. So hopefully he is not going to be set free anytime soon. Now, WWE and the Columbus Sports Arena were sued by a fan this week, alleging that he was injured in a fall at a Raw event last year. WWE, the Columbus Sports Arena, and Ohio State University and UMR, Inc. were sued on September 2nd by a William Ricks from Pennsylvania, alleging that he was injured after slipping in a puddle while attending the April 22nd, 2024 WWE Monday Night Raw event in Columbus, Ohio. Ricks' lawsuit alleges that he was walking in and around an aisle by sections 207 and 208 when he slipped and fell due to a hazardous condition that existed in the form of an unmarked puddle of a liquid or liquid-like substance. A liquid-like substance. Is that like Michael Cole at WrestleMania 37 with Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt saying it's a box-like structure? No, Michael, it's a fucking box. Not a box-like structure. It's a liquid. A liquid-like substance that was not open and obvious. The lawsuit alleges Ricks has suffered permanent pain and suffering in the form of injuries from the fall, but does not cite exactly what the injuries are. The lawsuit states that all of the defendants except UMR, which is an insurance company, owed the ticket-purchasing audience, of which plaintiff was a member, a duty to maintain the premises in a way that was free of any hazardous conditions. He is citing negligence, a failure to warn, and vicarious liability for all of the defendants except UMR. The lawsuit alleges Ricks may have had medical assistance with or received payments from defendant UMR for care and treatment rendered due to injuries sustained in the aforementioned incident. Well, if he has an issue, then he should take it up with the management of the arena, because I fail to see how WWE is in any way responsible in this situation. And I would be surprised, honestly, if they don't already have language on the back of each ticket covering their asses in situations just like this. I actually pulled out an old ticket that I have, because I keep a lot of my old ticket stubs back when they actually had tickets. Everything's digital now. But I pulled out one of my old ticket stubs to Raw from a few years ago to take a look at the fine print on the back. The fine print was so small, like if you put this thing under a fucking microscope, I still wouldn't be able to read it. I'm like standing here like I'm 75 years old. I need my monocle and I'm trying to read this shit and I can't. There's no way. Not a single one of you listening to this right now would be able to read what's on the back of this ticket. So I just put it back. But I would be very surprised if they don't have language already, you know, drafted on these tickets to kind of excuse them from situations like this and release them from any liability. I just don't see this guy having any kind of case against WWE. The arena, that's a different story. But that was not the only lawsuit to be filed this week. Per TMZ, Hulk Hogan's son Nick has sued Bubba the Love Sponge to block the release of a new documentary on his father that deals with the release of his old sex tape. It is the fucking sex tape that will never die. Hogan's son Nick is suing Bubba the Love Sponge, alleging the popular radio host's unreleased documentary about the WWE legend infringes on his dad's copyrights and trademarks. Nick, acting as a rep for Hulk's estate, filed a lawsuit on Tuesday in a federal court in Florida after Bubba revealed that he is going to drop Video Killed the Radio Star, the untold story of the Hulk Hogan sex tape scandal, later this month. Nick states that the documentary, which promises to tell the real story of how Hogan's romp with Bubba's then-wife Heather Klemm got leaked to the media, includes unauthorized images from the sex tape. In the suit, Nick alleges some of the video was actually played in a trailer that Bubba just recently released. Nick also claims Bubba has been promoting the documentary using Hulk's trademarks without permission. Additionally, Nick says releasing the documentary would violate a settlement agreement that Bubba and Hulk entered into over the tape back in 2012. The details of the agreement are redacted in the lawsuit. Nick is suing to stop the release of the documentary and for other unspecified damages. Fast forward to Thursday. A federal judge in Florida granted Nick's emergency motion for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, in part prohibiting Bubba from using scenes from the infamous sex tape in the dock. However, it looks like Bubba will still be allowed to publish the documentary as long as he keeps out the sex tape. The judge additionally ordered Nick to post a $500,000 bond, which would go toward damages Bubba might have incurred if Bubba ultimately wins the case. Bubba hosted an event on Friday night that Brooke Hogan attended, Nick's sister, unveiling the documentary. It was like opening night. So this hasn't stopped him from releasing it. I don't believe any actual like video footage from the sex tape is in the doc. I mean, I would hope not. Is in the documentary itself, so he must feel he's on solid ground here. But on the subject of the Hulkster, this will be a little more lighthearted here. Erica Nicole Clark is a stand-up comedian, and she is also the daughter of Mr. T. She recently shared a story from her childhood to explain why she often avoids telling people about her famous father. In a clip posted by the Don't Tell Comedy Instagram account, Clark recounted a chaotic weekend surrounding the first WrestleMania that involved a legitimate injury to her dad and a violent hotel room brawl between Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Roddy Piper. Clark began by explaining the complex that she developed as a child because no one believed her father was Mr. T. I'm a black girl at an all-black school, and I'm trying to explain to my friends that the reason why they've never seen my dad before is because he's doing WrestleMania with Hulk Hogan. Everybody was like, shut the fuck up, Erica. And those were the teachers. This experience of being disbelieved led her to stop sharing stories about her life. To illustrate her point, she told a story from the weekend of the first WrestleMania in 1985, where her father was teaming with Hulk Hogan. She was seeing wrestling live for the first time, and her dad had assured her it was all fake. During the match, however, her father suffered a real injury. She said, my dad gets into the ring, and immediately Roddy Piper flips my dad, and he cracks my dad's ribs. So my dad has to go to the emergency room. After Mr. T was treated and returned to their hotel room, all bandaged up, Clark described a tense scene. She stated that Hulk Hogan was in their room, still in his yellow wrestling shorts, and was doing lines of cocaine. See, now that I can believe. According to Clark, Hogan was furious over the injury and was vowing to get revenge on Piper, telling or yelling, T, I'm going to fuck him up when I see him. According to Clark, see, I can't believe this because he didn't say brother. If he said, I'm going to fuck him up when I see him, brother, I could have believed it. I mean, there's no brother, there's no Jack, there's no dude. According to Clark, there was soon a knock at the door, and it was Roddy Piper, who had come to apologize for the injury. He goes, I'm real sorry about what happened, Clark said. Hogan, however, did not accept the apology. Hulk Hogan's like, fuck that, and grabs Roddy Piper and brings him into the hotel room, throws him against the wall, smashes the mirror. She described a chaotic brawl breaking out between the two wrestlers. Clark painted a picture of mayhem in the hotel room with her father, despite his broken ribs trying to break up the fight. She recalled Hogan's then-wife Linda being there and yelling for him to stop using his real name, saying, Terry, Terry, stop it, which is how she learned that Hulk's real name was Terry. Amid flipped-over furniture, Clark and her sister were crying. We get on a plane. We come back to Chicago. I go to class. We're sitting in a sharing circle, and the teacher's like, "What do you do this weekend?" And I was like, "Not a fucking thing." You know, I've heard Hogan himself tell stories that are more believable than this one. Although him doing lines of cocaine is completely believable, especially in that era. Everything after that sounds like complete bullshit. Coked up or not, okay? Coked up or not, do you honestly think that noted tough guy, Hulk Hogan, was going to pick a fight with Rowdy Roddy Piper, who had an amateur boxing background and earned a black belt in judo, by the way, from Jean LaBelle? Okay, that's number one. I'm more likely to believe that Hogan really did audition for Metallica than any of that, okay? Not to mention, can you imagine if he had actually beaten up Roddy Piper? Do you not think he would not have been telling that story for years to anyone who would listen? Like, oh my God, we would never have heard the end of it. The night that I beat up Roddy Piper. I mean, it would have been in both of his books. It would have been mentioned at least once in every interview that he's ever given. Ain't no way he's keeping that one a secret. But it makes for a funny story for a stand-up act, I guess. And Variety had the exclusive this week that WWE would be adding episodes of the old Hulk Hogan rock and wrestling cartoon from the 80s to the WWE Vault channel on YouTube. I've been waiting for this since they pulled the episodes off the network 10 years ago. As soon as that Hogan scandal hit, they pulled all the episodes. They had just posted them too, I think like weeks before, and then they just pulled the entire series. So they will be releasing episodes in batches of four every Saturday morning. I love that. I love timing it for Saturday morning. They're going to be posting them in chronological order at 6 a.m., 8 a.m., 10 a.m., and noon every Saturday. And they actually just dropped the first batch yesterday. The show ran two seasons with a total of 26 episodes. It aired on CBS back in the day. None of the wrestlers on the show were voiced by the wrestlers themselves because their schedules just made that impossible, especially with the inhumane schedule that they were keeping back then. I mean, how the hell would you even get them in studio to do voiceovers? But, you know, it was Hogan, and then you had Junkyard Dog and Andre the Giant, and I think Ricky Steamboat and Jake the Snake. I mean, they were just, you know, all the key stars for the most part were represented on that show. Bobby Heenan and Lou Albano and so on and so forth. Cartoon Hogan had more hair on his head on the show than the real Hogan ever did at any point in his entire life. But his character was voiced by Brad Garrett of Everybody Loves Raymond fame. And Junkyard Dog, he was a character on the show. He was voiced by James Avery, Uncle Phil from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, who was also the voice of Shredder in the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon. See, this is my childhood, man. He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, Thundercats, the Hogan cartoon, Inspector Gadget, Ninja Turtles, the real Ghostbusters, Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Smurfs, and the Super Mario Brothers Super Show. Can't forget that one. Ah, take me back, man. Take me back. Let's take you to the mailbag. That's where I'm going to take you all. Email me your questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. And when you do, make sure you include your name and where you are from. We'll do two or three of them here. And then we'll get to more next week. Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota. I love that name. Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota. I had to say it twice. I had a possible idea for John Cena's last match. I understand the thought process of a Drew McIntyre or a Gunther being the last opponent makes a lot of sense. And a babyface heel match makes sense too, but I had a different idea to run by you. What if AJ Styles ends up beating Dom for the Intercontinental Championship? Around November, Cena starts talking about the end being near, and he brings up that he has done everything but one thing, and that is be the Intercontinental Champion. He challenges AJ for the title for his last match in December. I think it would be a great final match for John and could add some fun drama too, seeing if he could win the title that he's never won and have the added bonus that the ending would not be obvious. What do you think? I'm shocked by how many questions I have gotten in the last few months about John Cena going after the Intercontinental title. I mean, I guess I just underestimated how many people actually want to see this. Look, If it gets us one more John Cena AJ Styles match, that would be great. Cena challenging for the Intercontinental Championship is tough for me to see happening. I don't see Cena going on television and making that pitch that, oh, it's so important that I win. Like, that's not going to happen. Because John Cena doesn't care about the Intercontinental title. He just challenged, though, Sami Zayn on Friday for the U.S. title. But it wasn't anything he asked for, right? It was Sami Zayn who basically begged him to accept a championship match with him, and John Cena said yes. So could it happen? Sure. If AJ wins the title and he does the exact same thing that Sami Zayn just did, where he pitches the match to Cena and basically begs Cena to say yes, I don't think John Cena is going to say no to that. But that would be a Raw match. I don't see John Cena wrestling for the Intercontinental title in his retirement match. I think people are putting too much emphasis on the IC title and its importance to John Cena. John Cena has never, ever, ever, ever demonstrated that he gives a shit about any specific title, frankly, but the Intercontinental Championship. It would be like if Hulk Hogan was about to have his retirement match on Saturday night's main event, and he comes out on television and says, brother, it's the one title I've never won. I got to win the Intercontinental. Like, Hulk Hogan doesn't, he would wipe his ass with the Intercontinental title, okay? Like, I cannot even fathom him caring enough to even mention it in a promo as he was barreling towards his retirement match. So that's not going to happen here. But the fact that we just saw Sami Zayn and John Cena for the U.S. title on Friday at least makes it possible that WWE could get a television match, you know, out of Cena and AJ. Plus, we know Cena's done with SmackDown. So when we see Cena on television again from here on out, I mean, outside of the matches that he has on the big special shows, it's going to be on Raw. And AJ Styles happens to be on Raw. The IC title happens to be on Raw. So a match between them, absolutely, very possible. But to do it in the way that you just laid out, or to have Cena talk about how, oh, it's the one title I've never won. Like, again, he's never said or done anything to demonstrate that any of that matters to him. And I don't see them starting that now, and I would not do that. Certainly not in his last match. His last match should have nothing to do with any championship. And as far as his retirement match, I don't think that AJ Styles is the guy they want to go with. Because I don't see Cena winning that match. And I certainly don't think they want AJ Styles beating John Cena in his retirement match. I can almost guarantee you that's not what they want. So that I don't see happening. But I do hope the match does happen at some point. You know, we got a SmackDown match out of it. There's no reason we can't get a Raw match out of Cena and AJ one week. Simon from Coos Bay, Oregon. I know why she's had a job for so long, but real question here. Has Tamina ever had a good match in her career? I feel horrible, but every single time I ever saw her, I groaned and lost all interest. Sure, I mean, there was the I'm sure she's a lovely woman. And Mo from Harlem, New York. After listening to you answer a question about Roman Reigns and his opinions about the Attitude Era stars and their rise to the top, it got me thinking, from 1 to 4, how would you rank Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, and John Cena, and their rise to becoming a top star in terms of difficulty, 1 being the easiest and 4 being the hardest? That's interesting. So with 1 being the easiest, meaning they had the easiest sort of path or journey to becoming a top star in WWE. Look, first of all, before I even answer this, let me just say it is not easy to become a top star in WWE. It wasn't back then. It's not now. So when I answer this question, I'm not saying that, oh, it's just such an easy thing to become the biggest star in the entire company. You have to have certain qualities, tangible and intangible, to be put in that position. And the company has to believe that they can make a lot of money with you in that spot. But for some, it did certainly come across as if it was a lot easier for them than it was for others. So of the names that you just mentioned, the easiest by far, number one, is Hulk Hogan. Hogan was already a big name in the Twin Cities for Vern Gagne. That's why Vince McMahon stole him away. He wanted him back. He had already been in the WWF before. and he had success in the AWA, and Vince knew this national expansion was coming. His mind was already made up. He wanted Hulk Hogan to be the face of that. He wanted Hulk Hogan to be the poster child for it. Hogan, his physique, everything about the physique and the charisma was everything he was looking for in his wrestlers. All Hogan had to do was agree to come over and sign the contract. So when he came back at the end of 83, he was instantly a top star. And within a month, he beat the Sheik in the Garden and was the WWF champion. Doesn't get any easier than that. Once they did that, they were off to the races. So Hogan, number one. I'm going to put Rock at number two in terms of getting to the top as a top name, the easiest. I remember when Rock was first signed. God, who was it? Was it Pat? It was Pat Patterson, I think, who was the one who went to Vince and them and said, this guy's, he's going to be your champion one day. So like when they brought Rock in, they kind of knew he at least had that potential. And when you look at the, you know, the kind of the early part of his career, you know, he debuted at the Survivor Series in 96 and he won in Madison Square Garden. I think he was the sole survivor in his Survivor Series match. And within 3 months, they had the Intercontinental title on him. It blew up in their face. The fans rebelled, right? Die, Rocky, die. He joined the Nation of Domination later that year, and that was really the beginning of his rise. And from there, it was just this steady rise until a year later, he was the champion. You know, he won the WWF championship. He was still very young, but he was already a top guy in the company. Number three, I'm going to put John Cena. Took a few years. Cena won the title. He had only been on television not even a full 3 years when he beat JBL at WrestleMania to win the championship. And Vince made his decision. This is going to be our guy, you know. Cena won one title. Batista won the other. It's a funny thing, too, because Batista, you look at Batista and just his look and that physique. Like, if Batista came along like that, looking like that in the 80s, I'm not saying that he would have gotten the Hogan spot, but he would have been treated very well at the top of the card by Vince McMahon. I'm kind of surprised that Vince chose Cena over Batista in some ways, just based on that alone. But Cena, once Vince made his choice, he was the handpicked one, and you know, he held on to that spot for a good 10 years, 10 plus years. You know, he was the top guy in that company. Austin, I put at number four. I think Austin had it the hardest of the four in terms of how long it took and what he went through to get to that top spot. You know, Stunning Steve Austin had a lot of success as Stunning Steve in kind of the upper mid card in WCW. Got fired, I mean, very briefly was in ECW, but then Vince picked him up, and again, he was the ringmaster, and wasn't doing a whole hell of a lot in that first half of 1996. Only won the King of the Ring in 96 because Triple H got punished for the curtain call. Didn't have any real plans for him until later in the year when they were hoping to get Bret Hart back. What if, and by the way, what if Bret had decided not to come back? You know, that's a question I never hear anybody ask. You know, you get these what-if questions sometimes. And it's like, what if Bret Hart had truly decided in 96 that either he's going to retire or he's not coming back to WWF and he was going to go to... Because he had a standing offer from WCW. And what if he had made the decision to leave and didn't come back? And how would that have affected the career of Steve Austin? Because when Bret came back, Austin was the first guy to work with him. And that was huge for Austin's career. They had that great match at Survivor Series, but then when they ran it back again at WrestleMania, it's one of the greatest matches in the history of the company. And you get that iconic moment of him in the sharpshooter with the blood pouring down his face in Chicago. If Bret's not there, what effect does that have on Austin's career? I don't know. I still feel like he gets there eventually, but I think that really delays things. Because I'm not sure who he works with, if not Bret. Who does he work with that can help kind of elevate him to that next level, who is a big enough star like Bret was, that can help get Austin to that next level as like the new badass in the company? I don't know. That's a great what-if scenario. But Austin had to, he had to wait his turn, and it didn't come easy. But once he hit on that gimmick with Stone Cold and... Yeah, it's like catching lightning in a bottle. He found something that worked. He completely changed his look. if you look at him from the Stunning Steve days to the Stone Cold days. It just took him 8 years, though. You know, it took him 8 years to win that world championship for the first time. It took longer for him than it did for the other guys on this list. So I've got him at number four. But good question, Bo. I appreciate that. Keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Always love hearing from you guys. Thank you for all of the support. And everybody I saw on the streams this week, I'll be streaming Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So we're keeping a normal schedule this week. We're back to normal. All the international shows are over for the time being, just for now. They're going to be in Australia next month. But I'll be live for the Raw post show on Monday night on YouTube, the Dynamite post show Wednesday night, and the SmackDown post show on Friday night. And of course, live for Tuesday Night Titans over on JD's channel on Tuesday. That'll be episode 111. So plenty of content coming your way this week. Until I see you next Sunday, when I am back with you for episode 929, I bid you adieu. Be well. Stay safe. Enjoy your week. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Bronson Reed one-on-one against Jey Uso. So Uso got back in the ring, and he was looking for another suicide dive. He is stopped in his tracks because Bronson Reed yeeted. You talk about yeeting. He yeeted this fucking chair, this office chair, right at Jey Uso's head. And the referee calls for the bell for what you would assume is a disqualification. They called this a no contest. I would love to know, what do you have to do to get yourself disqualified? If Bronson Reed shot Jey Uso in the face, would it be a no contest? Like, where's the line here? When I saw that on the screen, I said, you gotta be shitting me. This man threw a fucking office chair at this man's head. A no contest?
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you so long.